Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A very full day in our second hour. Dr. David Corton is going to drop by. His new book, Agenda for a New Economy. How do we build an economy? I mean, a genuine economy that actually works for people. How do we reboot our system? How do we get away from fractional reserve banking and the Fed? And no, it's not going to be as wonky as that sounds. I mean, how do we actually create a system that works? David's been giving this a lot of thought, and it's going to be a good one. Christy Harvey's going to drop by in our third hour, and we're waiting to hear Alan Jablonski may be able to drop by also. We'll be in our third hour. We will be talking as the day goes on also about the housing bill, Barack Obama's housing stimulus, you know, part of the stimulus package. All of the details are not yet on the table. So far, it's looking good. He's doing the right thing. I think he's moving in the right direction, and we'll get to that. And also, there's an amazing story about private prisons that I want to share with you. We will get into that in our third hour as well. Right now, though, first of all, this is the kind of thing that very often slides under the radar, and very often could be really ultimately one of the biggest stories of our day. Back, a decade or so ago, there was a company, a biotech company here in actually in Oregon. I believe it was a European company, a British company, that genetically altered a bacterium of the name Planicola klebsiella, which is ubiquitous. It's on the roots of virtually every plant in the world, and it assists the plant in transporting mineral nutrients into its root system. And they modified this bacteria so that it would eat cellulose and produce alcohol. And they thought, this is great. We've got the ultimate product to make ethanol. And they were about to release it into the wild when a local PhD student decided to test the thing with either grasses or wheat, and discovered that it killed off the plants because it created alcohol in the roots, and the plants got drunk and died. And if this thing had gotten into the wild, it's remotely conceivable that it could have led to the death of every plant on Earth. I mean, now that's a far stretch, but it's not inconceivable that that could have been the consequence. And now we have scientists, that's just genetic modification. Now we have scientists talking about actually creating from scratch life forms. The primary one they seem to be talking about is a virus that lives on bacteria. These are called phages. And so with us is Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's a professor and director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania, bioethics.upenn.edu, the website. And in some ways, this even ties into the story of this woman who had this chimpanzee that ate her friend's face and it was so destructive. At what point is anthropomorphizing the universe around us and playing God a good thing or a bad thing? Dr. Kaplan, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you with us. In your article, in your op-ed piece, you talk about, first of all, you take on the notion of the word playing. Give us your thoughts on that.
Well, first, let me say I'm glad you're giving some attention to this. I do think it's going to be a major story in the next few years, trying to write this op-ed. I think it ran on the Discover magazine website. Is just a way to try and draw some attention in here in advance of some of these efforts at making synthetic life.
Right.
So when people say they're going to make a new life form, a new microbe, a new virus, a new phage, as you pointed out, something that lives on a bacteria, basically, the criticism falls under the rubric of, well, we shouldn't be playing God. And I'm not as moved by that objection as some others might be. I think that invoking the image of playing God is kind of, if you will, playing fast and loose with the notion of playing. Playing is what you do when you're kind of on a lark. You're not thinking through things responsibly. You're goofing around, in other words.
Right.
Playing has a sort of freewheeling and irresponsible connotation. I'm tempted to say, given recent events with steroids in the New York Yankees, it might even be more than freewheeling.
There you go. Yes. Well, actually, that's a variation on all of this, too, I suppose.
But I don't think any of the scientists involved are trying to play at this. I think they're taking it seriously. I think they're earnest. I think they both have commercial ideas in mind. They certainly want to understand the basics of life, which is part of the reason to try and make an entirely new life form. Playing, I don't think, is fair.
But at the same time, those motivations were the same motivations that drove, to some extent, that drove the company that created this genetically modified Planticola Klebsiella. And although they came to Oregon to do this, because at the time in the United States, unlike Europe, this is a European company, there were no regulations on what could be released into the environment, and there was no regulations on genetically modified products. And it could have been a disaster. What if they create a very, very simple virus, a phage, a virus that can infect a bacteria, and it turns out that, and let's say that they use a very common bacteria as its target, like Acidophilus, for example, mm-hmm. and this thing then becomes toxic to Acidophilus. Without Acidophilus bacteria in the guts, most mammals on Earth would die from malnutrition because they wouldn't be able to absorb nutrients. It would be the same thing as the Planticola Klebsiella situation.
So just to be clear, I think there are things to worry about. I don't like the playing image, but I do like the deadly serious. Are you, let's say, asking these scientists and the companies that might be behind them as they move out, just so listeners understand, you can make a synthetic life form in two ways. You can take it down to the barest of genes that might work to be alive, which wouldn't exist in nature, or you could start slapping genes together to make an artificial genome, a set of genes that never existed before, and you kind of combine them. So two ways to get there. I don't think that's playing, but I do think there's some deadly serious issues, and you're hitting on one of them. We don't have any oversight right now that still is adequate, in my view, either in the U.S. or, for that matter, worldwide. There's a little better regulation in Europe. There's no regulation in most of the world about the release and control of these organisms. So I'm not saying, there's nothing to worry about here. What I am saying is let's forget about the playing God business and is it our place in the universe to do this? I have a feeling that's going to become a mood issue pretty soon. They are going to do it.
But where are the boundaries? And also, where does the profit motive come into this? I would not be unsupportive, or I would not be as opposed to the creation of an artificial life form if it was being done by research scientists in universities who are funded by government for the purposes of pure research, the classic pure research, like, let's find the hadron, that sort of thing.
The classic basic science model.
That's right. I have a lot of concerns if it's being done by Monsanto.
Yeah, and I don't disagree, although I'll even say I have a little bit of concern about the basic science model, because both of them still require an environment in which we regulate and control where these critters go, who can release them, where they can be. And we don't have that in place right now. We don't have that framework.
It's being done.
It is moving along, and it is as if no one is paying attention here. We don't even know in the U.S., just to beat up on us for a second, what agency has authority over these things. Is it the FDA? Is it the environmental agencies? Is it the wildlife and fisheries people? We don't have a single agency that we could point to and say, hey, by the way, before this guy lets this out of the lab or puts it in a field or sticks it in the gutter somewhere or decides to put it in the ocean to try and make synthetic fuel or eat up pollution, there's some good uses for these critters. How much does it have to be tested? How controlled does it have to be? And I don't have to tell you and the listeners, if you just look around and see Japanese beetles or mollusks clogging up all the water pipes and the Great Lakes or all these fish being eaten by non-native species. We don't have a good track record in controlling
organisms. What if they came up with an organism that ate oil for oil spills, and then it turns out it starts seeping its way into the cracks and crevices of the planet, and pretty soon all the oil reserves are gone?
Exactly.
Exactly. The potential is mind-boggling. So, Dr. Kaplan, we just have a few seconds left, a half a minute or so. Bottom line, we need regulation of this?
We need
to get control of it?
We need two things. One, we need regulation very fast. We need to set up guidelines. We need transparency, just what you were talking about. The private guy shouldn't be able to do any releases unless it's open and transparent. And the third thing, we need to make sure some of this engineering information doesn't get into the wrong hands. Might have to restrict a little bit publication here so the bad guys don't start making bad bugs.
Right. So our question for the day, do synthetic biologists play God? Good one. Dr. Arthur Kaplan, thanks for being with us, Doctor.
Hey, my pleasure.
Great talking with you. And for that matter, to extend this, how far should humans go, for example, in not having domesticated pets, having chimps for pets?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you in part by the Teamsters, teamster.org, the website proud supporters of the Employee Free Choice Act and a fine union. This, first of all, just a couple of quick headlines, just a few updates of what's going on for the day. The New York Times now has joined the Washington Post in calling for Senator Burris to step down. I would add to that. I think that he's not good for the state of Illinois, frankly. I mean, that's the bottom line. You have to get back to what's best for the people you're representing. In Canada, Barack Obama is showing up. The Canadians are just going nuts. They are so pleased to see him. They were lining up like tourists before he even showed up. Keep in mind, when George Bush went to Canada, they had to have a huge security corridor, and there were all kinds of protests, just like when George W. Bush was inaugurated. They were throwing eggs at his car, and he had to race down Constitutional Avenue or Pennsylvania Avenue or whatever that street is there that the motorcade goes down, and he still got egged, although the press was very careful not to show that. They deleted that part from their news reports. It took Michael Moore to remind us of it in Fahrenheit 9/11. But nonetheless, that's what happened, and there were all kinds of arrests when Bush got inaugurated. When Obama was inaugurated, I was there. There were no arrests. It was a beautiful, peaceful day, and everybody just loved it. So that's going on there. And finally, Nancy Pelosi gave an interview to Rolling Stone magazine in which she said that she believes, well, I'll quote her. She said, the question was, do you foresee a scenario in which senior members of the Bush administration are actually prosecuted? Nancy Pelosi, quote, I think so. The American people deserve answers. Where we are now in terms of prosecution of White House staff is that we have charged them with contempt of Congress. We're talking about Harriet Myers, Josh Bolton, and Karl Rove. The natural course of events from here is that the speaker, she's speaking about herself, will determine what charge we're going to pursue, because there are many more than one. Under Bush, the Justice Department told the U.S. attorney not to prosecute these. So the beat goes on. It just gets worse. We don't know what will happen because they've delayed it a long time. So interesting. Now, back to the bacteria and the virus, the creating life forms from nothing. This is symptomatic of this larger issue. I think that there's a much larger issue here. You know, clearly we need to regulate these things, and we need to regulate them in a way that's different from the way we regulated genetically modified organisms. GMOs were regulated during the Reagan administration at the request of Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush on behalf of Monsanto in order to essentially legalize them, in order to provide a legal framework that would reduce the liability of the companies developing them. That's the wrong reason and the wrong way to and that's why to this day you can't find out whether the corn chips you're eating have genetically modified corn in them or not. There's no labeling laws or anything because of that kind of a regulatory environment during the Reagan administration. But the larger issue here is the issue of humans viewing everything on Earth as purely a machine. This Cartesian worldview, you know, from Rene Descartes, the idea that, you know, I think, therefore I am. What is it? Cogito ergo sum. And that the entire universe, that everything is just a machine. If we can only find the right levers to pull, then we can fix all problems. And that every other life form is purely here for us. And if we can't find one that's purely here for us, we'll create one for us. And what it does is it separates us in our own minds from all other life. It feeds this fantasy which... You know, in small form, you saw in the Bush White House viewing the Iraqis merely as pawns to move around a chessboard. Oh, yeah, we'll reorganize the Middle East, right? We'll just bomb them into submission. And frankly, I think it's being carried out today in Iraq and Afghanistan, tragically. This idea, it's hubris. And anthropomorphizing animals. Here's this woman who was living with this chimp. She was bathing with it. They were sleeping together. They were brushing each other's hair. Her child had died. Her husband had died. And she had what was clearly, and at least you know, from a mental health point of view, inappropriate relationship with this animal that went nuts. And it was, by the way, given some human pharmaceuticals, you know, mood-altering drugs. It went nuts and nearly killed her friend. And this is all over the news. This, of course, the MacGuffin that the artist in the New York Post says led to that god-awful cartoon that everybody's all upset about, of the chimp being shot, you know, and then the cops saying, now somebody else will have to come up with the next stimulus package. But the point is that this woman was viewing this chimp, and we, by and large as a society, view animals as something that's just here for our convenience. Let's create some new biological organisms just here for our convenience. The whole world just here for our convenience. So I am of the opinion, frankly, that wild animals right across the board should not be pets. And that, in fact, the whole idea of domesticating pets for things like fighting, you know, should we put an end to pit bulls? I mean, just say, you know, we're not going to breed these things anymore, for example. Should we ban the ownership of wild animals? How do we ban or regulate the creation of genetically modified organisms or brand new living organisms from scratch? I mean, there's a whole spectrum of questions here that all fall into this broad category of what's our appropriate role on Earth, we as humans? How do we interact with every other living thing and, frankly, with each other? Because for many years, I mean, you could argue slavery was an extension of this thinking, of viewing other humans as not quite human and simply here for the convenience of white Anglo-Saxon Europeans or white Europeans. So, anyhow, your thoughts on this, 866-303-2270, you've heard mine. We'll be back right after the break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, and downright strange stuff going on out there in the world, I'll tell you. Apropos of our topic, Ross Township, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania dog groomer been ordered to stand trial on animal cruelty charges. Why? He's selling gothic kittens. They have ear piercings, neck piercings, and tail piercings. Yeah. By the way, Attorney General Eric Holder has said the U.S. is a nation of cowards on race. He's our first black attorney general. And I think, you know, to a large extent, I agree with him. My question is, and Carl Wolfson framed this beautifully this morning on the morning show on KPOJ, my question is he going to be a coward on the prosecution of Karl Rove and the Bush administration? We shall see. We shall see. Anyhow, your thoughts on anthropomorphizing animals, creating the world in our own image. What is our own image? Do we create viruses from scratch? You know, all that kind of thing. It's just this is a topic that I'm telling you has the potential to blow up in our faces. And in fact, I would submit to you may already be. We have an enormous amount of genetically modified food in our food chain. And everybody's sitting around going, gee, I wonder why everybody's obese. I wonder why there's an explosion of type 2 diabetes. Could it be that it's not just high fructose corn syrup, that it's genetically modified food? Don't know. Mike in Huntington Beach, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. What's up?
I think you're being pretty naive about the whole thing. No offense, of course. We've been modifying our food for generations and generations. The only thing that's changed recently is the tools we use. I mean, the corn that's produced in the Midwest today is the result of 100 years of people modifying the crops to the point where they can't even reproduce on their own.
Well, it's the result, arguably, of 10,000 years of Native Americans modifying corn. I mean, you know, the idea of breeding, of selectively breeding plants for, you know, if you take the largest fruit and you keep breeding that. I mean, that has been around forever, but that's a really very different thing from using. You're right. The tools have changed, but using tools that can produce things that not only never did occur in nature, but never would have occurred in nature under any circumstances.
But we have that today in crops and animals. I mean, we have animals that we use for food and for different purposes that never would have created naturally. It was strictly by man altering it.
Should we at some point say maybe that's not such a good idea? Pit bulls, case in point.
Well, but take it the other way is to really change our dominance on using Middle East oil. We want to genetically modify crops to produce oil. If we could do that with tools that are very efficient, wouldn't that be a good thing?
Well, it depends. If we could generate the same amount of energy by using windmills and solar panels, I'd say we don't need to, and the risk of genetically modifying something is not necessary to take. So, you know, I'm saying Mike, good point, and we have always been, you know, creating hybrids. I mean, you know, in the Bible, I mean, there's a story of I forget who it was it Abraham? Was separating the speckled goats from the. I mean, there's all. You know, this has been going around forever, but we have taken it to a new level here. Will in Easton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I think that humans tend to be narcissistic, and unfortunately, religion, and in particular the Christian religion, until we're honest, talk about being brave about talking about something like Holder said. Until we start talking honestly about how destructive religion is and how it feeds our narcissism, how it makes people think that they are the center of the universe. I don't think we're going to make any progress with this issue. I agree with you, by the way, and a lot of other issues, how like essentially destroying our planet and being brutal about our survival. I think I'm not blaming religion per se, but until we have an honest discussion for one, like what Bill Maher does about how destructive it is, which we never do, I think we're going to be stuck spinning our wheels for probably forever on this issue.
Let me tell you what I think you're talking about. Most of our monotheistic religions have created essentially a scary sky god that is totally anthropomorphic, that is a human with superhuman powers, and as such, and we go to closed boxes away from nature that we call churches and synagogues and mosques and temples and whatnot to worship or participate in ways to get into contact with that monotheistic god. Or in the case of Hinduism, I suppose, even the polytheistic gods. And what we have lost contact with are the ancient roots of humanity, the animists, those who saw the spark of divinity in literally everything in creation, honored it, felt awe in the face of it. And I would submit to you that most of the mystics, from Meister Eckhart in Christianity, Isaac Luria in Judaism, Rumi in Islam, most of the mystics were at their heart also animists. They saw, you know, Brother Francis is famous for this. You know, The Little Flowers of St. Francis is a classic book, a collection
right.
of stories.
Okay, that's true. Unfortunately, we've strayed so far from that it's almost like we're so lost at this point that religion, to me, is feeding so much destruction.
This is why my call with regard to religion is to bring mysticism back into religion, because it's the mystics who I think can help religion become non-toxic. Because
I agree. Well, that's a good point. You're
when
right.
you just put God in a box, it frankly, in my opinion, it becomes toxic. Will, excellent point. Thank you very much for the call. Beth in Seattle. Hey, Beth.
Hi.
Hey, you're on the air.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you for bringing up this topic. I really appreciate listening to your show and hearing about intelligent issues that affect us on a daily basis.
Thank you.
I think you have a really great program. One of the things that I wanted to say today goes beyond the GMOs and the things that you're talking about that, you know, create, you know, these ideas of apocalyptic outcomes that we really should be afraid about, and we should be doing something about. We should be, you know, raising awareness about these issues. But our government needs to be responsible and do something to protect us, because we have no voice otherwise. And the thing that I want to bring up goes beyond GMOs and beyond the destruction of the planet and our environment and our food source and our water supply and all of that. We are exposed every single day through our activities and products that we come in contact with. We have no idea what the content of is. Mm-hmm. There are over 1,000 chemicals introduced every year, and the government does not do anything to regulate their production or their introduction into our environment or for exposure to humans.
Yeah, there are over 80,000 cataloged chemicals, and fewer than 800 of them have been defined as toxic, and fewer than 5,000 of them have ever been tested for toxicity.
Yes, there have been a number
for carcinogenesis, excuse me.
They're discovered by accident. We don't test these things before they're introduced. We wait until we accidentally discover that harm has been done.
Right.
These are things that have endocrine disrupting qualities to them, and we are exposed in utero without any knowledge. Others don't even know that this is happening to us.
Yep.
And 30 years down the road, we can't reproduce, and we wonder why we have a low sperm count or poor motility or learning difficulties or ADHD. All of these things can be and have been linked to endocrine disrupting hormones.
Right, which are in our water, which are, you know, the softeners in plastic is the primary source of most of many of these. But you're yeah, absolutely right.
It is a primary source, but
yeah,
so many things that we're
right.
exposed to.
And what we have seen is over the last 20 years, we've seen the average age of onset of menstruation in girls and onset of puberty in boys drop by 2 years, which is something that hasn't happened in the last several thousand years of any kind of medical records. Beth, excellent point, and you know, very well said. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Gordon in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Gordon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, been a long-time listener, and greetings from the ideological wasteland of Central Kansas.
Thank you.
But I wanted to call to say that, you know, genetic modification is simply accelerating and coordinating the process of natural breeding. And I've read your book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and I, along with you, believe that it's critical that we get off of fossil fuels to save the environment and also to save the civilization. And I think that there's some really good promise with the potential to convert CO2 into algae. Into bio-oil,
let me just challenge your assertion, Gordon, that genetic modification is simply, you know, an accelerated version of normal breeding. I would say it's a whole different thing. It's jumped out of that lane, and it's in the next lane over in the bowling alley, as it were, to use an awful metaphor. And it wouldn't have happened under other circumstances. We're not just pushing, accelerating a natural process. We are creating an unnatural process. And therein lies the danger.
I'm not so sure. And just a little while ago, you said that we're creating things that would not have naturally occurred in nature. But I don't see how you can say what would or would not have naturally occurred in nature. I mean, if you look at the fossil record, just an enormous variety.
Well, I'm suggesting that they wouldn't have, because they're not the consequence of evolution. They're not the consequence of even modified and accelerated evolution. Hybridizing things is accelerating evolution. It's pushing the variables that speed evolution. It's giving more opportunities to grow to a particular type of or variety or variation or mutation, and fewer opportunities to another. And this is actually creating the mutation, which is a different thing. And your point is well taken, Gordon, but I respectfully disagree. We'll be right back.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to Talk Radio for the Sane Among Us. Tom Hartman here with you. And Darren in Seattle. Hey, Darren, you're on the air. What's up? Darren? Darren?
No, yes,
Darren.
Hello, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air, Darren. What's up?
Thank you very much for having me on. Yes, I just want to make the point. I don't know if it goes along with your argument or if it goes against your argument. I think that the breeders of the pit bull are to be held responsible, and not the pit bull itself. The American Staffordshire Terrier has been around for a long time, and I think specifically breeding it for fighting has caused it to get a bad rap, and the environment in which it's put in.
Yeah, that's my point. It's like my take on illegal immigration. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem. We have an illegal employer problem. You have a system essentially that's creating a problem. And with pit bulls, you've got an animal that is being bred where the characteristics of aggression are being selectively selected for in the breeding, and the characteristics associated with the opposite of aggression, with friendliness and whatnot, are to some extent being bred out. I know I have a friend who has a Rottweiler. It's a very affectionate dog, but if it got loose in my neighborhood, I would be a little concerned, frankly. And should we simply say animals that have the potential to kill people, or for that matter other animals in large form, which takes us to wild cats, for example. A single cat can clear almost a square mile of birds. And one of the reasons that our cats have always been indoor cats. But then, am I playing God by having cats? It's a interesting point, Darren. Thank you for raising it. It's like unpeeling the onion, right? Rachel in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, Rachel, listening on KTRC.
Hi, Tom. One thing I want to point out, and I haven't heard this mentioned on any of the talk shows or read anywhere on any news stories, is that this primate was bonded to this woman, this female, a male primate bonded to a female, which, from his point of view, it wasn't a different species. He's not well socialized. He didn't recognize this woman as another species, and he reacted like any male of that species would react when his ownership of this woman was challenged.
So you think that the reason that this chimp went nuts with this woman's friend is because she basically jealousy.
Yes, and disregarding the problem of the human pharmaceuticals and all that, I just wanted to say that you pointed out that people have a tendency to view pets as machines or little robots there for their own pleasure, but this was an animal that literally bonded. And anyone who has a pet, especially cats, they know that cats bond strongly to humans, and they can't even see interspecies differences.
Yeah.
I would like to just point that out to people.
Yeah, no, I'm convinced that Higgins thinks I'm a cat, not that I'm a human.
Exactly.
I'm serious.
And it's a commentary on the amazingness of love to overcome the differences of species.
Right, and the danger of doing that with animals that have not been bred for 1,000 generations to be domesticated, basically. The danger of having a chimp is... Great point, Rachel. Thank you very much for making it. I appreciate the call. Sheldon in Cosa Mesa, California. Hey, Sheldon. All right, excuse me, Brandon. Brandon, you're on the air.
Sorry, Tom. I want to talk more about genetic modification. I've got a really good little anecdote.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of genetic studies on fruit flies because they can breed in a day. That's how long their lifespan is.
Sure.
So,
or a couple days. Yeah,
and so what happens is they hold them in these little jars, and they'll pull out one gene and replace it with another gene. And basically, an experiment that they did was they wanted to change the eye color and see what the gene was. So they pinpointed the gene, changed the eye color of these fruit flies from red to white. Now, just moving that one gene, changing the one single gene, was enough to change the behavior and change the sexuality of these fruit flies. So what you wind up with are fruit flies that are homosexual, and their whole behavior patterns are trailing each other around in these jars. My point is that one gene controls so many factors that genetic modification is just insane.
Right. The law of unintended consequences is never going to go away. In other words, yeah. Well said. Thank you very much. Bob in San Jose. Hey, Bob.
Yes. What I was calling about was, or one of the callers earlier was talking about, we were in effect just speeding up things that would normally occur. Well, I saw an interesting photograph on the web some time ago, and if I remembered exactly where, I could point you to it. But it was a gene from a squid put into a cat, and this cat glowed a light blue.
Well, the gene that has been added to genetically modified corn and other genetically modified animals is a gene that a fluorescent gene that I believe comes from one of the deep sea types of fish. It's
well, that
fish.
May be the similar kind of gene, but this was a house cat that glowed blue.
Yeah. See, these are things that would never naturally occur as a consequence of even accelerated evolution by human pressure. Yeah, excellent point. Thank you very much. April in Los Angeles. Hey, April.
Oh, hey.
Hi.
I just was calling because I've been studying actually GMOs at UCLA, and I mean GMOs have actually helped us in other ways. For example, like they can be bred, like plants can be bred with pest resistance or with naturally occurring herbicides, so that actually we're reducing our pesticide use as a result. And on
right,
top
but the
of that,
but the, like the BT corn, for example, that has Bacillus thermophilus, as I recall, that corn is now, you know, in some cases that gene, the BT gene, has now jumped into the wild, and now you've got weeds that are resistant to these insects. And so what's going to happen? The insects will just develop resistance to BT, or, you know, you're going to wipe out a whole class of insects that are part of the food chain for birds.
I mean, I don't think thus far we've been necessarily wiping out. I mean, there hasn't been anything proven to where we've been wiping out animals that have.
April, I strongly suggest you Google butterflies, birds, and BT corn, and you will be amazed at the actual studies that seem to indicate that we're seeing crashes of specific species as a consequence of BT corn being out there, this genetically modified corn that contains its own pesticides. I'm not asserting that it's an absolute fact, but I think that there's a lot of evidence that indicates that. Thank you for the call, though.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club, providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. Okay, here's the question. How do we create an economy that actually works? That works at a national level, that works at an international level, that works? David Corton used to teach at the Harvard Business School, Harvard University Graduate School of Business. He worked with the U.S. Agency for International Development for years, with the Ford Foundation, throughout the 1970s. is an MBA and PhDs at Stanford University Graduate School of Business. He currently is president and founder of the People Center Development Forum, chair of the board of Yes Magazine, board member of the Business Alliance for Living Local Economies, the author of The Great Turning, The Post-Corporate World, and When Corporations Rule the World, a prophetic book. And my friend, David Korten, Dr. David Korten, on the line with us. His website, David Korten, DavidKorten.org. His new book out, and you got to get this book. It's brilliant. Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. David, welcome to the show.
Tom, it is always a delight to be on my favorite talk radio show.
Bless you, David. Thank you. How do we create, well, first of all, you say from phantom wealth to real wealth. Let's define those two terms.
Yeah, well, the large message of the book, of course, is that we have currently a choice between reviving what I call a phantom wealth economy. Now, that's an economy that is devoted to creating money out of nothing to increase the power of a few rich people without producing anything of any goods or services of value in return. So we can be focused on reviving that economy, which is in fact what most of the bailout and stimulus efforts been trying to do. Or we can focus on replacing the phantom wealth economy with a real wealth economy, which is an economy of real people, locally rooted businesses that are designed and devoted to produce good services, meaningful family wage jobs to meet the needs of everyone. It's such an obvious and foundational choice, but it is not really even part of the current discussion, which is why I felt the need to write this book.
Well, I don't think most people can even imagine reinventing the system. I mean, we've had a couple of major reboots in the history of this country. The failure of the creation of the First Bank of the United States back in the late 18th century, the failure of the First Bank of the United States in the early 19th century, the failure of the Second Bank of the United States 15, 20 years before the Civil War, the creation of the Fed in 1913, and, the Jekyll Island Conference, the creation of the IMF and all that sort of thing. I mean, there have been a few milestones that have brought us to this current system. Are you suggesting that the whole idea of fractional reserve banking, of having a banking system that is a private, basically a private corporation, the Fed, even though there are some entanglements with government, the chairman of the Fed is appointed by the president, as it's kind of like a, yes, we'll bow to you sort of thing. But an economic system where the creation of money requires the continuous growth of the money supply, because it never creates enough debt, it never creates enough wealth, never creates enough money to pay off the debt that is the engine that drives the creation of that money, if I'm saying this right, should be blown up and we should start over again, David?
You know, Tom, one of the things I like about you is you always go right to the heart of the problem, and that is the bottom line problem of our current system. And it's interesting you also talk about, most people can't imagine actually changing it by intention, and perhaps our starting point is to recognize that over the history of our country, the folks who are dedicated to controlling the wealth of the country have been involved in very active social engineering, institutional engineering throughout to undermine democracy and shape the system in their favor. Now, what's going on Wall Street? I think of Wall Street as a criminal syndicate because it is basically engaged in theft and extortion from the rest of society. Now, understanding the power of Wall Street depends, first of all, what they're engaged in is could be called a perfect crime, because basically the theft they're engaged in is legal, and even better, it is largely invisible, so we don't even realize what's happening.
Now, hang on just a second here, David. I think most people think that if somebody wants to start a business and they can go out and raise money in the public market by offering stock, and then that stock becomes a commodity in and of itself, which can be exchanged amongst other, consenting adults. And so somebody creates an exchange to swap that stock around after it's been created to create the initial wealth to fund the company. I mean, this is, the basis of capitalism, that's not such a bad system. What's wrong with that, and why is that theft?
Well, the whole question is whether the transactions involved are actually creating real wealth or whether they're simply creating or expropriating money and value from others through creating financial bubbles, charging usurious interest rates,
right.
Creating debt pyramids.
So can we insert a cleavage here between the issuing of stock in the first place, that is raising money to start a business, and the trading of the stock? Is that what you're suggesting, that the trading of the stock is not creating real wealth, whereas perhaps the issuing of the stock in the first place actually does? Or do you dispute that too?
Well, that gets down to one piece of the problem, but I'd rather for the moment, Tom, stick on a bit larger picture of why Wall Street has such power. This is the invisible part, which is the fact that we've created an economy in which our lives depend ever more on money to meet any of our most basic needs, which then gives enormous power to the people who are in a position to create and decide who gets money. And,
right.
And that, of course, is the Wall Street game, and that whole money system, that whole thing of how much, where money comes from and how it's decided who gets it, that's what makes us such a wonderful, perfect crime, because most of us are not even aware of how that works, so we're not even aware of the theft. And the other side of this, of course, I make the distinction between Wall Street, which is a metaphor for that pure money, that pure expropriation economy, and Main Street, which is the economy of real businesses and real people.
Well, that was my point, is that the issuing of stock, the creating of a company, I mean, I've never publicly issued stock, but I've created a number of companies where I've had investors buy into the company, and then ultimately, in every case, I bought them back out again, and they made a profit. But and that, I think, worked to the benefit of certainly to me, and I think of society, in as much as we were doing something of some value, at hopefully in some cases.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
So, but then there's a huge leap to having a publicly traded stock, where you go into a stock exchange. So David, we're talking about David
Corton. The issue there is between grounded ownership, ownership by people who actually who know you, who are living the same community, who have an interest in that business beyond pure financial gain, who recognize that
right.
You're providing jobs and you're being environmentally responsible, so they're going to have a healthy environment. It becomes a totally different thing when you move into trading in global stock exchanges, where you get a complete disconnect between the rights and powers of ownership and the
right. But what happens, David, if let's say that you and Fran start a business, you decided to take Yes Magazine profitable or for profit or something like that. You start a business and I say I'd like to kick $50,000 into this thing to help it out, and I invest in it, you give me some stock in the company, and then God forbid I have a heart attack and fall over dead, and now Louise has inherited that stock, she's not interested in being a stockholder, she needs to sell it to somebody. That's where a stock exchange comes into place, isn't it?
Well, that is the justification for the stock exchange. Now, the issue that we face as a society is, yes, that's a real issue. You have to transfer ownership at some point. But the challenge before us is to figure out how to keep that ownership local and in the hands of people who have a real stake in the business, and to discourage particularly people who are coming in to trade on that stock in the hope that there's going to be momentary fluctuations in price that they can get a hold of.
Right. Isn't one way, though, to discourage things like day trading or trading in general, to tax transactions?
Absolutely.
We did that up until 1966.
Also go back to a graduated capital gains system where we distinguish between short-term and long-term capital gains, which encourages longer-term holding. But I think this is an important issue, but we've got to look at it in the much larger context.
I'd like to pull the camera back and take a snapshot of that very, very larger issue that you're talking about and try and get my hands around some sense of we can't even call it post-industrial, what a post-modern world might look like. Can you stick around after the break? We got to take a break here. And,
sure.
And can you stick around because I find this fascinating, and I know my listeners do. Why Wall Street Can't Be Fixed and How to Replace It. The new book is Agenda for a New Economy by David C. Corton. His website, davidcorton, KORTEN.org. Of course, the book available in bookstores all across the country and from the usual suspects. The subtitle, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, Agenda for a New Economy. We'll be right back with David Corton.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What happened? Does anybody know? What happened? Where did America go? Everything Walmart all the time. No more mama, papa, five and dimes. What happened? Where did America go?
Well, we're still here, actually. America is. It's just we've gone through a few transformations, and particularly over the last 28 years, as we've wandered into Reaganomics, Thatcheronomics, general craziness. But a lot of that craziness began, arguably, way back with the development of the fractional reserve banking system and putting it in private hands. David Corton is on the line with us. His new book, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. David, we have just a few minutes here, maybe 5 minutes in this segment. Let's just nail this thing down. What would an economy look like that actually was not in the abstract, but in what would it look like to the average person? How would their life be different? What would the institutions be different with which they interact? How would their job be different? How would their how do they pay their bills differently if we were to go to the kind of system you're suggesting?
Well, it's nice that I've got 5 minutes to cover that, Tom. Basically, everything has to change. A lot of it, though, means going back to living in ways that are a whole lot more like how we grew up back in the 50s and 60s, where our economies were much more local, where they were comprised mainly of local businesses, where we grew much of our food locally, and with a whole lot less chemicals and artificial agriculture, and certainly none of that genetic engineering you were talking about. It would be an economy where our primary focus is producing and exchanging the things that we need. It would be a system in which our banks are local institutions that take in local savings and then make loans to local people to buy homes, and instead of securitizing and selling off those loans, the bank holds them. It holds responsibility, so it has an interest in making sure that the people and businesses that it loans to survive.
And it seems that all those things could be accomplished by basically changes in tax or corporate law, saying that banks cannot have charters outside of a state. They have to have a state charter, or they cannot have a charter. They cannot operate within more than 500-mile radius or something like that. That locally grown food will have some sort of a tax preference, or imported food will have a tax added to it, something like that. Essentially,
absolutely.
Tariffs.
And one of the things that's very interesting right now in terms of the banking system and the money system, which goes back to the really foundational issue: who controls the money and for what purpose?
Mm-hmm.
The fact that a lot of establishment thinkers are now and politicians are now calling for a nationalization of the banks. That's a huge, I think, positive opening, but we have to make sure that that's not just about government taking over, fixing them up to give them back to Wall Street bandits, but to reverse that whole process of consolidation and restructure them to spin off their local offices as local community banks or mutual savings and loans, community-owned institutions to serve the community. We also, I think, have a unique opportunity to deal with that whole issue of bank-created money, because we're in a desperate situation where the government has to get the economy going, but hopefully in a new direction. But instead of borrowing the money to do that back from these same private banks that created the problem, moving to a system of government issuance. I think
right.
That's an issue that's just ripe to get on the table.
That would require the Treasury Department to buy the Fed, would it not?
Well, I'm not sure of the technical details, but basically it would seem the most natural thing would be for it to take over the Fed.
Right. And there being stockholders in the Fed, they'd have to be reimbursed.
I think you've had discussions on this. I'm very taken by Stephen Zarlinga's American Monetary Act that I believe Dennis Kucinich is trying to introduce into the Congress. That gets into a lot of technical details that I don't think we need to go into here, but that's the essence of it.
Yeah, that's the bottom line, basically, is let's have our money supply be in the hands of Americans. And, in fact, our Constitution says, you know, the Treasury Department shall be responsible for minting currency and minting coins. And, you know, it's been weirdly interpreted in such a way that if you have a nickel or a dime or a quarter in your pocket or a penny, that's actually manufactured by the U.S. Mint, and that's actually U.S. currency. That's actually from the Treasury Department, not from the Federal Reserve System. It's not counted as part of the Federal Reserve's money. Whereas if you have a dollar bill in your pocket that says Federal Reserve note on it, it's a whole different system of money.
Yeah,
this makes
I mean, the
no
government
sense
issues
to me.
The pennies, and the private banks get the real money. It, you know, it's such an amazing thing that you know the money folks have managed to reduce the taxes on the rich, which means then that the to pay the cost of government it has to borrow, so it's borrowing the money back from the people who should have been paying it out in taxes in the first place, and of course also buying it from the renting it from the bankers, either our own bankers or foreign bankers. Which is absolute insanity when we could just be issuing that money directly in a government system where the government manages the money supply for the public.
Do you know of any countries that are doing this right now, David? We just have 15, 20 seconds.
Yeah, that you know, these things are so so amorphous, it is very difficult to tell what countries are doing what.
Yeah. And I understand Canada bought back their Fed for like a year or two, and then they reprivatized it. This was back in the 60s, I think, but I'm not an authority on it. Ellen Brown knows about that stuff. But this the book, David Corton, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth, a brilliant oversight of the problem that we have and a whole variety of ways to solve it. David Corton, KORTEN.org, his website. David, thanks for dropping by today.
Thank you much, Tom.
Good talking with you. It is 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. 866-303-2270.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call
6-6-303-2270. And I got to tell you know, is it time to reboot capitalism? Let's take a look at even the assumptions, the core assumptions. In the United States right now, for example, we have 2.1 million people right now in prison. That's a 500% increase since Reagan became president. Now, what has changed since Reagan became president? We have allowed a private prison industry to take root and to flourish. In fact, a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, it was the fastest growing construction-based part of the entire U.S. economy, the private prison industry. And here's where it gets truly bizarre. This is what happens when you mix profit with the commons. Consider the story of Jamie Quinn. Amy Goodman, by the way, writing about this over at truthdig.com. Jamie Quinn, 14 years old. She describes what happened. I got into an argument with one of my friends, and all that happened was just a basic fight. She slapped me in the face, and I did the same thing back. There were no marks, no witnesses, nothing. It was just her word against my word. This fight led Jamie into a Pennsylvania court where the judge sentenced her to 11 months in prison, in a children's prison. She told Amy Goodman, she said, people looked at me different when I came out, thought I was a bad person because I was gone for so long. My family started splitting up because I was away and got locked up. I'm still struggling in school because the school system and facilities like these are just horrible. She began cutting herself, writes Amy Goodman, blaming medication that she was forced to take. She says, I was never depressed. I was never put on meds before. I was there, and they just started putting meds on me, and I didn't even know what they were. They said if I didn't take them, I wasn't following my program. She was hospitalized 3 times as a consequence of this. This is one of several cases that Amy lays out. Now, why did Amy, or why did Jamie end up in prison? Because two children's court judges in Pennsylvania, judges Mark Ciavarella and Michael Conahan, took $2.6 million in kickbacks, in bribes from a private prison to feed them children. So kids came before these judges for literally slapping a friend's face, and they ended up in a children's prison. This is how bizarre it has gotten. The Juvenile Law Center's Bob Schwartz told Amy Goodman, again, the reporter with Democracy Now!, and you can read this over truthdig.com, talking about Hillary Transu, another kid who got locked up. What was her crime? Hillary had posted a website parodying the assistant principal of her school. She intended it to be a joke. The assistant principal took her to court, and the court put her, after a 90-second hearing, put her in the children's prison. The private, corporate, for-profit children's prison. I mean, this is absolutely amazing. And well, actually, it's not at all amazing. This is what happens when you insinuate into what should be the commons, our criminal justice system, the profit motive. It's why drug testing is a multi-billion dollar industry, because there's money to be made in it. It's frankly, in my opinion, it's why pot's still illegal, because it has become a multi-billion dollar industry. The law enforcement part of it is an industry. The private prison part of it is still an industry. I mean, this is... We have capitalism run amok. It's time for us as a country to start saying, where does the commons begin and end? And what is the more appropriate domain of private capital? And how do we regulate? How do we constrain private capital so that it behaves in ways that helps and grows and strengthens communities rather than destroying them, rather than devastating them, rather than destroying the lives of people like these kids? 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your thoughts on these issues. Wayne in Sonoma, California. Hey, Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Mike, I enjoyed your last guest and the thinking outside the economic box. But there was two things he mentioned that I didn't quite agree with. He talked about nationalizing the Fed.
Mm-hmm.
And I would certainly suggest that we marginalize the Fed, not buy it, not pay off these thieves, but simply marginalize it by issuing U.S. notes, the same way Kennedy did back in the 60s.
Kennedy never did that.
Pardon me?
Kennedy never did that. That's a.
I have. You go to any coin store and buy Kennedy's U.S. notes.
Notes?
U.S. notes, yes. Instead, it says at the top, United States note instead of Federal Reserve note. They were issued as money, millions of dollars worth, in May of 1963.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
Pardon me for
it's
being
the same
astounded.
Thing Lincoln did, huh?
Yeah, no, I know Lincoln created a currency. In fact, Obama referred to it in his speech on Lincoln Day. You know that Lincoln brought us a United States currency, and I've heard the stories, and usually in the context of this is why Kennedy was killed because he took on the bankers. But I've not seen a U.S. note, and I didn't realize that.
I'll be glad to get you one if you'll allow me to send it to your. I'm sure your address is.
Well, I can track them down myself if they're real. I'm going to have to do some research here, Dwayne. I really appreciate your educating me on this.
Well, yeah, and all they'd have to do is issue enough U.S. notes to pay the interest to the Fed. You know, you talked about debt money and never
right.
being enough to pay the interest. All they'd have to do is issue U.S. notes, a couple trillion dollars of them, And that would have been a good way to stimulate our economy would be to print them up and mail $1,000 worth to each person instead of sending them a check on the Federal Reserve.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. Dwayne, I got some homework to do. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Ron in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Ron.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Just fine. What's up?
Well, I heard your call about the prison system, and I happen to be doing 30 days right now for growing 5 plants. They tried to charge me with a felony, you know, and I fought it for 2 years. I didn't want to do the plea thing, but I ended up doing that just to get out.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't have the felony, you know. But,
yeah.
One thing they're doing now, they're starting to charge people to put money in their commissary. They're charging them 20%.
So 20% of what?
20% of however much money they put in. If somebody puts in $10 for you in your commissary, they take 20%.
Oh, as an administrative fee?
I guess.
In other words, if somebody puts in $20 for you to buy candy bars or cigarettes, then they skim 20% off the top. Is this a private prison that you were in, or a private jail, or is it a county or a state?
Well, I'm in a county prison, but it's half of the inmates, probably more than half the inmates, are federal inmates. They're getting paid $200 a day to keep, and you know, it's just. And
right, so counties are getting in the business too.
Right. Everybody's, and they're trying to make money off you any way you can. You know.
Are you calling from jail?
Well, I'm on work release. I have a picture. I shouldn't even be saying that. I guess it's not illegal. But I have a picture frame shop, and I'm at my.
Oh, so you're at work. You're working.
I'm at work. Yeah. I listen to you every day, and I just.
Oh, great.
This really gets my goat. This whole pot deal. I mean.
Yeah, me too. I think it's nuts that we be putting people in jail for growing something that used to grow in their backyards normally, and it's just, you know, it's just nuts. And you know, we are in our conversation with Dana Pinchbeck the other day, we encourage the drugs that expand ego, you know, the amphetamines, the legal ones, the Ritalin, the alcohol, the tobacco, the addictive one. But we discourage the drugs that challenge ego, the drugs that might lead to a more shamanic or a more existential experience. And you know, I just find that so wrong. It's
crazy. Well, they hand them out too in prison. Now, you know, it's easy to get Thorazine. I mean, you can go in there and they just want to.
Oh, really? They'll give you.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Here, have some pharmaceuticals. You're in for drugs. Great. Here, have some drugs. Amazing.
Exactly. And
Ron, I got to move along.
I have a prescription for Marinol. You know, so
is Marinol the prescription pot?
Yeah, I had a doctor give me a prescription for that.
That's great.
But they won't let me take that in there. I tried to kind of show.
Yeah. There you go. Okay, Ron, I wish you well and good luck, and I wish you well in your business as well. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you, David in Miami. Hey, David, a minute to the break. What's up?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
Okay, that's good. No, well, long time listener, first time called in. Well, as far as the judges that in that system right there taking the kickbacks and whoever was bribing them as well, I hope they all get prosecuted.
Yeah, they're looking actually at 15 years in jail.
Convicted, and I hope they spend all their time right next door to some of the adult offenders who used to be some of the juvenile offenders whose lives they took away from them.
Yeah, actually, I correct myself. They're expected to serve 7 years in federal prison, each of these two judges. But see, I'm telling you, this is the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, well,
you know,
for people
like
that,
it's like cockroaches. You know, you count five, you know that there's 500.
Well, people like that violated the public trust like that, I think they should have basically the full weight of the law thrown against them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And thank you very much, David. Well said. And this goes beyond. We need to think of this in the context of not just, you know, a couple of bad judges taking kickbacks from a private prison, but rather, which is the way that the corporate media typically spins these things, is, oh, look at this, we caught some bad guys. They never want to ask the question, is the system itself broken? We should not have private prisons.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
We've got the men and the women and the dying with the children for a presidential ribbon. They don't understand. I think it's time for change.
Seems like a plan to me. 47 minutes past the hour. Well, it's got to be later than that. 50 minutes past. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Every week we share with you the, very briefly, it's just this is a two-minute segment here, a success story that advertisers are having advertising on Progressive Talk Radio. And our advertiser of the week has a minute to describe their product, tell us, you know, what they do and all about it, to share that with the national audience. And then a minute to let us know what their experience was advertising on one of our local affiliates around the country. Today it's Ken Trujillo. He is the owner of Pianos and Pianos, and a nonprofit, Piano Pathways. The website, Pianos, N, just the letter N, pianos.com. And the nonprofit site is pianopathways.org. Do I have all that right, Ken?
Yes, you do.
Great. Tell us about Pianos and Pianos.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. Pianos and Pianos, we're a retailer, and we do pretty much everything concerning pianos, including sales. Our real big feature is the unique technique piano teaching method, and we guarantee to teach people to play in 8 weeks. It's a very exciting methodology.
Really?
We've been doing it for over 20 years.
I would love to learn to play the piano in 8 weeks. Do you have anybody in Portland, Oregon who's franchised?
We haven't gotten that far yet, but we're working on it.
That is great. That is great.
It's a wonderful thing, and music, you know, brings so much to people, and it enhances memory, quick thinking, motor skills, accuracy, all the good things that we want enhanced.
Absolutely.
And it's very exciting to be able to get the different walk of life in the classroom setting. We have everything from judges to pilots to IT people to just, you know, every walk of life you can think of.
Right. And kids, too, I would assume.
We do. We have toddler classes and we have classes for teens. And we mix the curriculum so that you're not just learning simple things like Twinkle Twinkle. We have a very exciting curriculum.
That's great. We're talking with Ken Trujillo. He is the owner of Pianos and Pianos. Pianos, letter N, pianos.com, his website, and the nonprofit pianopathways.org. Ken, what was your experience advertising on KKZN, Denver's Progressive Talk 760?
It's been really amazing. And first of all, I really want to thank our rep, Tanya Gates. She's been incredible in terms of helping us design a marketing plan that is really fitting for the talk radio show. And we're just excited. In fact, the very first day that we advertised, we received something like 4 to 5 calls. We've been averaging around 10, at least 10 calls a week. It's been amazing.
That's marvelous. So you would recommend that other people consider advertising on their local progressive stations?
I'll tell you, it went beyond our expectations, and I definitely recommend.
Ken Trujillo, Pianos, letter N, Pianos, pianosandpianos.com, the website, and of course, pianopathways.org. You can learn all about that by checking out that website. Ken, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. And thanks for advertising on Denver's Progressive Talk Station, AM 760 there in Denver. Nathan in Los Angeles. Hey, by the way, let me just toss in, apropos of our last caller, Louise and Sean have tracked down Executive Order 11110, the one that Kennedy issued that allowed him to issue these U.S. notes. And he did. He printed a bunch of money. From the $4.3 billion worth of U.S. notes were brought into circulation. They were silver certificates against any U.S. silver dollars or U.S. bullion in the Treasury. And I will share more with you about that as I learn it. Nathan in Los Angeles, so listening on K-Talk. Hey, Nathan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I don't want to take too much of your time here, but I've actually read the Federal Controlled Substances Act of 1970.
Right.
And I just wanted to let your listeners know it's available online. You can read it. It's the one that pertains to illegal drug use and possession laws. Mm. And if you look in the enumeration of powers within the United States Constitution, in brief, it says it lays out what the Congress can and cannot write law about. And what it says is it can tax anything. And what you see in the Federal Controlled Substances Act of 1970 is a taxation law on the purchases and sales of these kind of drugs, and it's not just marijuana. It's any kind of drug that's classed into.
Right. No, my understanding is that the way that they criminalized pot was the same way that they criminalized alcohol. Well, actually, with alcohol, they amended the Constitution. But the way that they criminalized pot was by saying that you were violating the tax laws by and because
exactly.
You had to have a tax license, and then they wouldn't issue a license.
They prove it. Yeah.
Right.
Then they have nothing. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Real quickly, Tom.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I just want to let your listeners know that the place to look within the Federal Controlled Substances Act of 1970 is in the exceptions clause at the end, where it actually spells it out within the law so that they could pass it through the House and the Senate, that people who are registered with the federal government, as in a medical marijuana user with your state government, who then registers with the federal government, then you are exempt from the Federal Controlled Substances Act.
Very interesting.
And
okay,
it says it in the law.
Thank you, Nathan.
Sure, thank you.
Interesting bit of information. By the way, Executive Order 11110, which allowed the president to issue currency, that currency stopped being issued when Lyndon Johnson became president after Kennedy's assassination, but that has never been repealed. So any president can continue to do that. That's interesting, too. Jeff in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Great show, by the way. Thanks very much. Two things. As far as imprisoning people for minor crimes, of course, you know that we imprison more people per capita than any other nation, and I believe it's
and in absolute numbers as well.
I'm sorry?
And in absolute numbers. You know,
yeah,
China has a population of 1 billion people. We have a population a third that size, maybe a quarter that size, and we have more people in prison than China does in absolute
numbers. I believe a big reason for that is the growth of the law enforcement and privatization of prisons industry.
Yeah.
And as long as we have those people are profiting and their salaries being made, it's never going to decrease. And we have people lobbying on behalf of those people to create laws that are stricter and stricter. And so until we deal with that problem, it's going to continue.
Because one of the groups that has historically lobbied for stronger pot laws, for example, and for three strikes and you're outlaws, is the private prison industry. And you say, what's wrong with this picture? Since Reagan came in and introduced this insanity of privatizing prisons in the 1980s, the number of people in prison in the United States has gone up 500%. We have become a gulag. This is just so wrong. It's so very wrong. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Thanks for listening to the AM 620 KPOJ podcast, sponsored by the Better World Club. Providing travel services, auto insurance, and 24/7 nationwide roadside assistance, but not part of the highway lobby. This is Tom Hartman, Better World Club member since first moving to Oregon. Check out their eco benefits like the nation's only bicycle roadside assistance and their e-newsletter, Kicking Asphalt, at betterworldclub.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. And the housing bill, of course, at the top of the news right now. Barack Obama yesterday laid this thing out. We're still short quite a few of the details. But the broad strokes are there, and some of the details are being filled in. And so I wanted to bring on Alan Jablonski. I know he keeps up on this kind of stuff and reads these things with some thoroughness. He's a consumer rights attorney, a licensed mortgage broker, the author of Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, ajconsumerwatch.com. And Alan Jablonski, welcome back to the show.
Great to be back with you, Tom.
So, Alan, give us the overview on this housing bill.
Well, I'd like to tell you that I could tell everyone the details because they won't be releasing the paper that is going to be describing everything until March 4th. But some of the things that I've heard already is raising concerns. The homeowners have been promised over the last year through Hope Now and then Hope for Homeowners that they were going to have their mortgage difficulties fixed and they could stay in their homes only to be foreclosed on at a later date. Right now, we've been told they're going to spend $275 billion. They're not spelling out exactly how all that money is going to be spent. $200 billion is going to be earmarked for Fannie and Freddie, but they didn't specifically say what that money is going to be used for, and it will probably be used purely to stimulate new home buying by increasing Fannie and Freddie's capital reserves. The $75 billion that they're stating that there is going to be used for those facing foreclosure this year, which they estimate at 3 million households, that gives each household $19,000 each if you do the math. Mm-hmm. And that's not enough to save anyone's home. There's going to be, according to the London Times, in the next 2 years, $1 trillion worth of loans resetting. This is the option arm loans that we're starting to head into the reset phase. People got conned into this loan. They didn't understand what they were really going to have to pay to stay on top of this. And I don't think the details of this proposal are going to help too many people.
Hmm. That's not good news, Alan.
I wish I could come in and say that that it was something that that was going to save a lot of people, but Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan, was interviewed right after President Obama's press conference, and he was very happy to state that they're not going to lower anybody's principal load on their house. Now, if the proposal says that you've got to get down to 31% DTI, which is your mortgage cannot exceed 31% of your gross income. You may have other debts, your credit cards, your car payments, et cetera, but they're going to cap that at 31%. There's no way the vast majority of distressed homeowners are going to qualify for this just based on a interest rate lowering. And Mr. Dimon slipped up a little bit yesterday when he said that they were looking to lower interest rates for five-year periods, et cetera. You might as well just give them an option arm loan, and they're trying to put the problem off a few years off in the future.
What, in your mind, would be a fix that it would actually work, or has this like gone beyond the point where it's fixable?
Well, if you had asked me that a year ago, I would have said that the market has to stabilize itself, and some people just weren't meant to be homeowners, and there were going to be a lot of foreclosures. But if the government's going to bail out Wall Street with $800 billion, what's another $800 billion to help out homeowners that are losing their homes? I'm not talking about the speculators that went out and tried to become real estate moguls by owning three and four properties. Just keeping homeowners in their homes that assists everyone. If they would lower their the mortgage principal, not even to what the market value is today, maybe a little bit above market value, most of these people could afford those payments.
Right. And would that cost $800 billion? It seems to me it probably wouldn't.
I'm throwing a number out there just for the fact that if the government can spend that much money helping out Bear Stearns, Bank of America, Citibank, if the banking industry is that important to the country, which I can't argue it is, who set the lending standards?
Yeah. Much of that money, by the way, that is going to those banks is going to pay for their workers in India who are taking your phone calls about the PIN number on your credit card.
Surely, and they're buying up they're buying up regional banks that were solvent to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah,
but sadly, the voice of reason, Secretary Baer, who has been calling for help for homeowners for the last year and a half, and I've always referred to her as the voice of reason coming out of D.C., she went on a morning show this morning saying this is going to help. And a big tell about this over the last couple of weeks, the people who were meeting with the Obama administration were the lenders and the loan servicers and the investors. There were no consumer advocates sitting at that table, and if they were, I'd like them to stand up and say what happened in that room.
Yeah. This is starting to sound like our concern about, the Clinton administration redux. Very, very unfortunate. So Alan, we're talking with Alan Jablonski. His website, by the way, ajconsumerwatch.com. Do I have that right, Alan?
Yeah.
I missed my page here. Yeah, what can people do then between now and the time that some relief may come available? I mean, there are going to be some Band-Aids that are passed out here, and there are going to be some people whose wounds are so minimal that apparently all they need is a Band-Aid. But although you seem to be saying that, you know, to stretch this metaphor a little bit, that those infected with cancer are not going to get much help. What can and should people do? How do they connect to this stuff? And if they're not eligible for any kind of assistance under these programs, what do they do?
Well, I would strongly suggest that they not act on their emotions. First of all, owning a home, it's very emotional. You know, when I was down for 2 years with a back injury, to lose my home, I didn't want to let go of it, even though I had trouble paying my mortgage at a particular point.
Yeah.
When I got back on my feet, you know, I caught up with my mortgage, and we could save our home. It's not just a house to people, it's their home. And don't allow the promises of these loan modification companies that we're going to come in, we're going to save you, just send us $500, $1,000, $5,000. I've heard up to $12,000 that these companies are getting. Don't run to the first person who promises you that they can save your home. You're going to be throwing good money after bad. A general rule would be, if you hear or see a advertisement on television or radio that we can modify a loan and save your home, they're what we would consider in the legal business a mill. They've taken
the
thousands of clients, and they're not going to give you the personal attention. They're not going to review your documents to see if you have any legal arguments. I have talked to a lot of attorneys across the country. I would suggest that people take a look at the National Association of Consumer Advocates website.
Mm-hmm.
Just Google National Association of Consumer Advocates. You can do a little search to see if there's an attorney in your area.
Right.
And see if they will take on your case to do a modification. There's some good ones out there.
Right. You might want to put a link to that off ajconsumerwatch.com.
Actually, I'm discussing that with them right now. But
yeah,
I can't, because I'm a mortgage broker, they probably allow me to. There's 1,200 attorneys. They can't have a business interest in anything. They're very strict about who can join the ranks.
Right. And the bottom line is get a lawyer and have them look over your documents. You may be the victim of fraud, and you may have some action against the bank, and certainly at the very least you can use this to postpone things like foreclosure, right?
You can use it as a way to stave things off. Another point that I have to make is
Very quickly, please.
Oh, even the attorneys who claim we'll do a forensic audit,
mm-hmm.
Their focus should be, what are your finances first? Finding things wrong with your loan documents is not going to help you if you can't afford your home.
Right, or the lawyer. Alan Jablonski, ajconsumerwatch.com. Thanks, Alan.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Chose. Not only did we pay attention.
Yep, the song that was removed from the movie and the current versions of the stage play, Annie. Thank you, Herbert Hoover. And that's kind of crazy, actually.
Maybe I'm crazy.
But this is even crazier.
Maybe you're crazy.
You know how baggy pants are fashionable in some places? In some demographic groups? You know, some kids of a certain age, let's say. A Pensacola burglary suspect was literally caught with his pants down while trying to run away. Yep, he stuck up a convenience store, ran off with handfuls of cigarettes, smashed a door on the way out. But the problem he had was he needed a free hand to hold his pants up. And he had two handfuls of cigarettes, and his pants fell down, and he fell down, and the police fell on him. Yep. So there's a Darwin Award waiting for that guy someplace. 866-303-2270, your telephone number. Dwayne in San Francisco. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I got done. Your comments about silver certificates and confusing them with U.S. notes?
No, it's what I was saying is that the U.S. notes were not silver certificates. That's the old currency that we used to issue, and gold certificates as well before that. But that the if you read the executive order, the 11110, the one that Kennedy signed in mid-63, it says that each one shall be backed up by an equivalent value of silver in the U.S. Treasury. Or in the U.S. in the vaults, or silver in circulation in the form of U.S. coins, silver coins, and so it was a currency that was backed by silver.
The ones actually issued, the ones with Secretary of Treasury Douglas Dillon's signature on them,
right?
Were just said U.S. notes.
That's right. That's what they say on the coins. It says
and
U.S. note.
And they are quite distinct from the silver certificates, which were being redeemed in that period. I know because I
That's
have
correct.
Thousands of them.
That's correct. That's correct. You're absolutely right. These are not silver certificates, but the enabling. The executive order which enabled this to happen specified that the quantity of those notes that were published could not exceed the value of the silver in the possession of the U.S. government.
We would have real reserves, but it wouldn't be issued in that form. But
that's
a number of books get this wrong. But can I add on your other guest on the sucker loans that people took out?
Sure.
Why don't we just declare the increase in the interest rates to be unconscionable? And just require them to pay their current payments and let the banks eat them.
Well, this is what Bernie Sanders is suggesting. Let's bring back usury laws and make it illegal to charge more than 12 or 15% interest. And even that, I mean, the old usury laws that Nixon threw out were 10%. It used to be illegal to charge more than 10% interest. And,
yes, and
let's just go back to that, and that's going to reset everything.
That would solve our problem. And without burdening our grandchildren with this debt, I know this would be there would be certain problems with the derivatives market, but let's take U.S. notes and put them in our local banking system and our state chartered banks, and let the Fed take care of itself.
Well, and if we were to just continue to operate under Kennedy's executive order, we probably have enough silver, or maybe that could be expanded by executive order to include the gold in Fort Knox. We certainly have enough to issue enough U.S. notes to hand to the Fed and say, okay, the $10 trillion debt that the U.S. has, we no longer have. We're no longer in debt, so we're not paying you interest anymore. And that would be a wild ride. Anyhow, Dwayne, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. Well, actually, the interest is against the Treasury Department because, I'm going to have to learn a little more about how that would work because the interest is bonds, and bonds are not issued by the Fed. They're bought by the Fed or sold by the Fed in order to influence interest rates and currency reserves. But the bonds are actually issued by the Treasury Department. Got to scratch my head on that one a little bit. Richard in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Richard.
How you doing, Tom?
Just good. I'm just great. Thank you.
Tom, this is I've talked to you before. I work with BlackBoysInCrisis.com, and I got two things about the guest, Alan Jablonski. I think that on the left, we really need an organized response to this issue because the mortgage plan that Obama put out, it was woefully short, and they knew it was short. And this is an issue that now they've had over a year to get something together on this, going back to early in the campaign, and to come up with something that's this woefully short that basically addresses the people who are, let's say, 60 days away from foreclosure when every single month, the foreclosure numbers are going up higher and higher and higher.
Yep.
And to write all of those people that are 60 to 90 days in and to basically just write them off, I give Obama like a B-plus for everything he's done so far, but I think this issue is so important. We don't want to be like the Republicans were with Bush, just accepting everything that comes through. We got to have an organized response and some pushback on this issue.
Yeah, I agree. I still want to know more about the details of it, but you're absolutely right, Richard. We need to be standing up and speaking out if and when appropriate. My concern is that he's listening to Larry Summers. He's listening to some of the old Clinton people, these, sort of halfway between conservative and liberal economists. And as Paul Krugman points out, it's just nowhere near what we need, Frank.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
When I was just a youngster, a good time loving funster, this is what my daddy said to me.
What'd he say?
He said, now get up off your rear.
Uh-huh.
Pay attention and you'll hear.
Uh-huh.
How to be a success from B to G. And he said, plumbing, that's what's coming. Everybody's pipes, Lord, they've got to be a running. If you look, I think you'll see.
And welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour.
Farmer had raised chickens since he was 24.
Uh-oh.
Working for the colonel for 30 years or more, killing all the chickens and sending them to fry. Now it's payback time for ghost chickens in the sky.
Yep, our ghost chicken slash pigeon alert for the day. An actual study has been done that was published in the Proceedings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, a AAAS, and that where they checked out pigeons, and they found that pigeons had the ability that they thought was unique to humans to understand relationships between things that never repeat from trial to trial, thus proving that it wasn't just similar, just plain old memorization. It was actually what we refer to as cognition, as thinking. And this, of course, is big scientific news. And I, of course, could have told you all along that that's the case because you're testing robots.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
They're robots on the planet Xenu. Of course, they've got intelligent chips in them. Come on. But, you know, to put a serious note on it, actually, it is pretty impressive. And it's not just pigeons, by the way. They did this with a number of animals. And baboons, for example, was the other one. They were testing baboons and pigeons and humans. And they all have, we all have cognitive abilities. We are more connected to the rest of the animal kingdom than any of us have ever imagined. Louise in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Louise, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling about the PA judges who accepted the bribes.
Yeah.
And in our little area here, it shows how convoluted and incestual this whole private prison system is. Mm. It turns out that the man that owns the company that paid the bribes,
right,
is the son of one of our former state superior court judges, okay? He is the brother of our current district attorney.
Ooh.
And his sister is now also running for the Court of Common Pleas.
Wow.
I mean, it's just, and this is a little hometown story that I've, like, taken some interest in. They've reported on it in the papers here, but it seems like it's so politically, radioactive. I wonder where it's going to go.
Yeah, that's amazing. Louise, thank you for, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story.
That's it. The details, right?
It's pretty amazing. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for the call. Carrie in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Carrie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing? Great. Thanks for having me on.
want to touch on that cartoon. I guess you talked about it before, and I missed what you had to say about
that. Yeah, the shot chimp.
This
is the cartoon, and let's just put this in context. Sean Delonis is the cartoonist. It's in the New York Post. And Sean Delonis has a long history of doing cartoons that are, in my opinion, I think, frankly, if you go over to Gawker.com, they've got a whole, a gallery of his cartoons up that are homophobic, that are racist, that are, in particular, homophobic. They've got one bunch of doctors with the transgendered guy who got pregnant, looking at him in delivery, going, any suggestions? And they're all kind of freaked out. They've got one where the reaction to the midterm election, where the Democrats won, and you've got all the Osama bin Laden and all his buddies waving flags and cheering, hate the Democrats. Here's one, the New Jersey marriage licenses, the one woman sitting at the window, and an obviously gay guy comes up to the window, the marriage license window, with a sheep next to him. I mean, these are the kind of cartoons that this guy has done in the past, and for him to assert, or anybody else to assert, that he had no idea that historically in America one of the racist characterizations of African Americans has been as primates is absurd on its face.
Right, I agree with you. I have one more question. Does Murdoch? Do you think he actually writes off on this? Does he know that these
cartoons are going on? Murdoch hires the kinds of people who would sign off on this kind of thing. But
right.
He lives in another bubble altogether. I doubt, I'd be surprised if he even reads the New York Post, much less has any day-to-day involvement in it. But the point is that he hires the Roger Ailes's of the world who run Fox News, who hire the Sean Hannity's of the world, who hire who hire the Bill O'Reilly's, who hire the guys who go out and stalk people. There's a corporate culture there that makes this kind of thing not just possible but inevitable. It should surprise nobody that this came out of an organization, out of the New York Post, that's owned by the same guy who owns Fox News Channel. It should surprise nobody. And their protestations are absurd on their face, in my opinion. Carrie, thanks a lot for the call. Andre in San Jose. Hey, Andre, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to encourage someone in the media to follow up on this debt-free money that I've been reading up on, and unfortunately I just can't find anyone from the mainstream media talking about it. The only thing I'm finding is from like people who seem to sound like conspiracy theorists. So I'm just trying to figure out how legitimate it is, and from my research, what I've done seems pretty legitimate. It's been done in the past.
Yeah, it has. We've done it in the past. We did it right up until 1913 with the creation of the Fed. And the way fractional reserve banking works is the only way that you can create money right now in our current system. Actually, there's two ways. One, the government can mint more coins, which is a damn inefficient way to do it because, you have to carry around a lot of coins if you're going to pay your mortgage with them. Or alternatively, when the Fed creates money, it creates it by banks creating debt. Every time debt is created, it expands the money supply. Every time debt is paid off, it diminishes the money supply. And this is a system which is dysfunctional from the get-go and is designed only to make a profit because it always the amount of the interest on that debt, it gets skimmed off the top by the bankers. It only makes a profit for the bankers. It doesn't benefit the United States of America.
Yeah, so why is this such how did it get to this point? When it was enacted, apparently it was snuck through Congress on December 26th when everybody was out of Congress.
Yep.
And, at a point like this where all global economies have a stimulus package out there that basically says the exact same thing, why isn't there someone yelling and screaming that, hey, the only people benefiting from this are bankers and not no one else?
Because bankers are a whole lot more powerful than you would imagine, Andre. And I'm not just talking in like the movie The International, which is actually a great movie about bankers, but about BCCI. But you've got people who are literally handling trillions or tens of trillions of dollars, and they have mind-boggling power. They have the power to bring a government to its knees. They can manipulate the currency of entire countries, and the politicians know this, And they live in fear of these people. I mean, basically the bankers have taken over the world. And you can read that on the hard right conspiracy theory sites, and you can read that on the hard left conspiracy sites, and you will not hear a word about it in the corporate or mainstream media because everybody wants to stay in good with the bankers. But our fractional reserve banking system, this banking system that we have, doesn't serve us well. It was sold to us in 1913 as a way to prevent depressions after the panic of 1907 it was 1907, the panic of 1907 and the Great Depression of 1896. Right. I mean, there were two major economic disasters / crashes that had happened in the 20, 30 years before 1913 that brought about the creation of the Fed. And it didn't stop the Great Depression from happening.
Yeah. Right. And it didn't stop this from happening. And actually, from what I read at the World Bank, what the policies they're trying to implement in the next few weeks, it looks like they're using this disaster or crisis to implement a new system of world money.
Yeah, one of the things that they're doing, a number of countries now as part of their stimulus, is they've borrowed money from the World Bank. And when the World Bank gives you money, then you've got to adopt neoliberalism in the European sense, not in the American sense. We would call it Reaganomics or Thatcheronomics. You got to privatize your Social Security system. You've got to give the bankers more power in the system. You can't have things like a national health care system, all those kind of things. Andre, I got just 1 minute left. I want to get another caller in here, but yes, well said. Tim in Los Angeles. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, everybody. I just wanted to say that with all this talk about money and dirty judges, on our money is the words "In God We Trust," and I think that is a telltale of the biggest wedge issue that's been put on man throughout history, and that is to divide him against himself and not to trust himself, but to trust judges or trust other institutions like banks to do the right thing. If we can fix this system to the point where we have the guts, and this is where, nation or world of cowards, the guts to say "In us we trust" on our currency, we will then maybe prevent these problems from occurring again like they did since FDR, good old FDR, and we'll finally have democracy on this planet.
Yeah, well, it says "In God we trust" because you can't. They're not saying "In the Federal Reserve do we trust," because we can't. Yeah, "In we the people we trust." I'd love to see that. Excellent point. Tomorrow, Friday, Brunch with Bernie, our weekly national radio town hall with America's Senator Bernie Sanders, plus Anything Goes Friday. We'll see you then. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
If I am looking at a United States note right here in front of me, signed by Douglas Dillon, series 1963, $5. There it is, the currency that is not the Federal Reserve note. Very interesting. Hey, the mystery of Ireland's worst driver has been solved. Yep, this guy had over 50 different tickets. He was pretty famous. Prawo Jodzi. Everybody was trying to figure out, who is Prawo Jodzi and why is he in all these different locations being stopped by all these different police officers all over the country for all these different moving violations? Turns out Prawo Jodzi is Polish for driver's license. Yep, the Irish cops were pulling the driver's licenses of various Poles who were caught driving and having driving violations in Ireland and looking at the driver's license and thinking that the words "driver's license" were the person's name. Wrote it down, put it in the computer database, and then went off looking for the guy. Ellen Rader with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's happening in the world today?
Well, I let's just start out. You know, I usually like to start out with some interesting financial data, and the Department of Labor said that the producer price index rose 0.8% in January. It's larger than that expected by economists. I say this every single day. And as you know, the core consumer price index does not include food and energy prices. So it looks like we're already getting some inflation here.
Right, which might be the consequence of George Bush having borrowed almost $2 trillion in his last year in office and $1 trillion the year before that, and all the off-budget stuff from Iraq and everything else.
Speaking of Iraq, let's move to Syria for a second, where the United Nations inspectors are saying that they are finding some traces of uranium at a Syrian site. This is the IAEA, and they are going to send their report to the 35 member nations on that. Speaking of member nations, it looks as if today was actually the day that the Justice Department filed against UBS in court in Miami to try and get these names of these people. And it looks like it's not just like 50 names. It looks like there are hundreds and thousands of names of people who have these offshore accounts.
17,000 Americans. I mean, keep in mind, there's only I think it's fewer than a quarter million Americans. It's fewer than 200,000 Americans who have a net income of over $1 million a year. And we're talking just a couple hundred thousand people. And 17,000 of them have these secret Swiss accounts in UBS, the United Bank of Switzerland or something like that, the UBS Bank anyway, where you can have numbered accounts in order to not have to pay income tax, in order to hide the money.
And the Swiss are now saying, well, that's going to spook our whole industry, because their whole industry has always been numbered accounts, where people, whether it be Mrs. Arafat or other people, have always long been able to sort of hide away their money.
Right. Every tin pot dictator in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of interesting. Also, Nancy Pelosi was over at NATO today. NATO is also planning an anti-piracy surge. And they are trying to figure out, they're having actually a meeting in Poland about that, how they're going to work on all of the piracy issue. The president is in his first foreign trip today, and he is in Canada. And in addition to security issues, et cetera, the whole issue of oil shale, environmental issues, all of that, and, of course, reopening of parts of NAFTA are coming up. Now, something else very interesting. First of all, when the feds get you, as you know, they get you. There's almost, if the feds have got you for something, don't even waste your money. 90% of federal cases against somebody go into, you lose in federal court on a criminal. Well, now they're also beginning, this is not criminal, but it's when the feds get you and when the reporters start to get you. Now they're going into the whole issue of Senator Burris, Senator Roland Burris from Chicago, and now they're trying to take a look at what he declared on his lobbying form for the Senate and what he said he lobbied when he was in the state when he was lobbying the state legislature in Chicago.
Yeah,
so they are really piling on.
Yeah, he needs to just resign. I mean, he's such damaged goods right now. There's no way that he can win an election in 2 years. The Democrats very much need somebody who can win an election in 2 years. Pat Quinn is a good man, a very progressive. He's not tainted by the Blagojevich taint. And if he were to make an appointment to replace Roland Burris, it would I'm sure be very high credibility and welcomed by both the members of the U.S. Senate, Harry Reid, the leadership and whatnot, as well as the citizens of Illinois, I would think.
One last piece of bad news. Over 100 members of Congress, and I think it was both Democrats and Republicans, actually it's 104 members to be exactly, got earmarks from one lobbying firm that lobbying them. PMA is the name of the lobbying firm, and they've hit up over one-fourth of the House. Hard to believe.
Wow. Wow. That's not the lobbying firm that's going out of business this week, is it?
I don't think so. No, yeah. No. But they are very tied to John Murtha.
Ah. Oh, interesting.
But I think that they're also I think there's also Republicans. I mean, every lobbying firm in Washington has Republicans and Democrats at it. There isn't such basically a thing. You know, when you leave Congress or whatever, you're friends with the guy across the aisle because the two are you going to make MONEY.
But didn't Tom DeLay have a thing where he said, if you've got any Democrats working for you, you're not going to get any legislation out of me? I mean, wasn't there a short while there?
You know, even if it's a hands, even if it's like a hands away, you know, so that it's two firms, one's a Democrat, one's a Republican firm.
So you just spin off another company with a couple of their partners.
That's right. That's how it works.
And maybe that's why there's over 36,000 registered lobbyists now, and when Reagan came into office, there were about 300.
Right.
And multiplying like bunnies.
Right, exactly. You know, they, whatever.
Yeah, incredible. Ellen Radner, thank you, Ellen.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Great talking to you. And I will repeat it. This is not the Twilight Zone alert. I will say it again. Tomorrow is Bernie. And don't forget, democracy does begin with you and with me and all of us getting out there and getting active. And maybe even with our getting a national currency and issuing U.S. notes. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great day, and we will see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.